And good morning, Park City. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. I'm Jennifer Dobner, filling in for Roger Goldman, who's out today. Looks like it's going to be a great day. Let's find out what's in store for our weather. Here with a report is Seth Sanders with the ABC4 Weather Center.
Happy Friday, Utah. Today's temperatures are going to be much cooler than they were yesterday. We had a cold front roll through yesterday evening, and that brought an increase in cloud coverage and breezy conditions with cooler temperatures, running about 10 degrees cooler than we were yesterday. Today's daytime highs will be a few degrees below average. In Park City, we're expecting a high in the mid-70s, 77 degrees specifically. The Heber Valley running just about 8 degrees warmer with a high in the mid-80s. Clouds from last night's cold front are still sticking around, so we do expect a mix of sun and clouds through the Wasatch back, especially towards Park City. Mostly sunny skies for Heber City. There's not a whole lot of moisture associated with these clouds, so unfortunately, we're not expecting any precipitation. Partly cloudy skies hold on into Saturday with temperatures similar to where they'll be today. Daytime high of 78 degrees in Park City and Heber City topping out at 84 for this Saturday. As we get into Sunday, temperatures do start to warm back up, hitting the low 80s for Park City, upper 80s for Heber City, and the clouds will continue clearing on out, making for clear to mostly clear skies. Things continue to warm up as we kick off the work week. We're going to be topping out in the mid 80s. In Park City and low 90s for Heber City Monday and Tuesday, and clear skies are expected. By the time we get into Wednesday, that pattern could change just a little bit. Some moisture will start to move in. That'll bring an increase in cloud coverage, at least temperatures in the 80s and 90s again. And there is a slight chance of precipitation. It's not going to help with our drought conditions or our elevated fire threat all that much, but we'll take anything we can get. Could get a couple of mountain drizzles, but it's looking like it's mostly just going to be Virgo, which is when it evaporates before it hits the ground. And the temperatures will continue climbing as we get through the middle of next week and into the end of the work week. Overnight lows throughout the week are going to be in the mid to upper 50s for Park City, while Heber City is a little bit cooler with overnight lows in the mid 40s to upper 40s. From ABC4, I'm weather forecaster Seth Sanders. Have a great day.
You're listening to the Local News Hour. Coming up, I'll be speaking with Linda Jager and Clayton Scribner about the new Park City Municipal Podcast. Then Chris Cushing of the SE Group will join us to talk about the art and science of snowmaking. We'll finish the hour by speaking with Scott Stewart of the Wileman School, who's going to talk to us about the preparations for the new school year. Stay tuned. And after the Local News Hour, we'll be having our regular Friday community campfire. This week, we're going to hear from Julie Wilson, a longtime Park City local who helped make Deer Valley what it is today. Singer-songwriter Elizabeth B. stops by for a campfire music session and an in-studio concert. And don't forget the Campfire Kids, Coach Skinner Sports, and plenty of fun facts and local events. It's the community campfire, Fridays at 9 a.m. on KPCW. They're your stories and your voices. Before we get started with Local News Hour guests, let's hear about some local news. After months with no discussion, the Oakley City Planning Commission is again considering a bid to develop the town center. KPCW's Christine Weller reports residents want to keep Oakley's small town feel.
Businessman Steve Smith's bid to develop the center of Oakley was back in front of the City Planning Commission Wednesday to get initial feedback. The master plan proposes adding a convenience store, car wash, and a 16-pump gas station on the west side of State Route 32, north of Center Street. A diner, retail space, grocery store, post office, town hall, and food bank are proposed for the east side of SR 32. Also to the east, on the south side of Center Street, the plan would add three apartment buildings with a total of 36 units and 40,000 square feet of commercial retail space. A farmers market parking lot combination is also proposed. The area includes the existing Brooklawn Creamery. Built in 1929, the historic building would be restored to as close to its original state as possible. The project, which the commission last saw in May, also features a proposed high-end restaurant east of Miller Race Road. The plan includes over 400 parking spots, but the development team emphasized they want the area to be bike-friendly and walkable. The team wants to continue a footpath along SR 32 to Stevens Grove, and over 30% of the project is dedicated to open space. During the public comment period, 15 Oakley residents gave feedback. Like many, Ted Campbell expressed concerns the plan involved too much development. He said he moved to Oakley in 2018 because it's a quiet town surrounded by natural beauty.
Tonight I stand before you not to oppose progress, but to raise a red flag about a kind of change that could fundamentally alter who we are as a town, and not for the better.
Robert Gordon agreed, saying an apartment building would cause Oakley to lose its charm. Thomas Schultz also wants Oakley to retain its small town feel. He objected to the size of the proposed gas station.
God knows what we need 16 pumps for in this town.
Michelle Campbell said the gas station's size and location are, quote, a death trap waiting to happen. And while she's in favor of some growth, she said the proposal is too large. Heather Masson said she wants more responsible growth.
I feel like this is a pretty egregious plan for a quaint small town that we are. It would be nice to have some retail with apartments above. We don't need the gas station. We don't need a car wash. We don't need a high-end restaurant.
The Planning Commission opted to table a decision on the master plan for 60 days to allow more time for discussion. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Firefighters from multiple agencies and Forest Service crews are working to contain a new Summit County fire first reported in the Uinta Mountains yesterday. The Forest Service says the Beulah Fire is burning in the Uinta-Wasatch-Cache National Forest between Mount Beulah and Lamont Peak. That's a few miles from the Manorlands and east of Mirror Lake Highway. It's estimated that the fire has burned about 200 acres after fire crews originally said it had covered between 300 and 400. The Forest Service says smoke jumpers, who are firefighters that parachute into remote areas, were called out but had not been able to jump because of high winds yesterday afternoon. Wyoming's Uinta County Fire and Ambulance Service said crews had not been able to access the fire on the ground because of its location. Utah Department of Public Safety helicopter was called in to help with evacuations in the Uintas east of the Christmas Meadows area. Recreators are asked to stay clear to allow crews to safely fight the flames. The fire comes amid red flag warnings affecting most of the state because of gusty winds and no rain in the forecast. Stage 2 fire restrictions are also in effect, banning open fires in unincorporated lands and some national forests. The area where the fire sparked is not under Stage 2 restrictions. The cause of the fire remains under investigation. Park City Municipal is debuting a new podcast. Here to tell us about it, our community engagement manager, Linda Jager, and communications manager, Clayton Scrivener. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Hello, thanks for having us.
We are happy you are here. So tell me, what inspired you to develop a podcast? And just tell me that.
sure. Thanks, Jennifer. Sorry. We actually at the city, you know, we have a mission to meet folks where they are and making information accessible to residents in an easy format and of what they choose and when it's convenient for them. So we have several platforms. We use social media, newsletter, a lot of our events where we go out in the community. But we were looking at for an opportunity to be able to share stories in a little deeper level. And, you know, podcasts continue to grow as a great news source. And we thought, let's give it a try. And it's really an opportunity. We're seeing it as a platform where we can tell or share stories that are we don't have the room for on something like a newsletter or a quick news update when we come here in KPCW. So really history behind some of the legacy projects in Park City, some of the people behind the projects in Park City, things like the budget, which is in our first episode. It's a great story to tell, so we're happy to have about 20 minutes to share it.
So tell me a little bit about the format. Like, are you going to have a host, and what kind of plans do you have for storytelling?
Well, it's hosted by Claire Wiley, familiar face around these parts.
She sure is.
And it's, the first one's 20 minutes long, but that's not set in stone. A lot of this is kind of, we're going to figure out what works as we go forward. And that goes to the point that we want people to help us guide what they want to listen to. That's what this is all about. Linda brought up the first episode was budget. I just want to give an example. Like, as I was listening on my commute up here, I was like, light went off. I was like, yeah, we never get to explain the difference between a capital budget and an operating budget. We don't come on the radio and explain that to people, or why we do a fiscal year. And a podcast is perfect format to share that kind of story. Like, if anyone's ever wondered, it's also going forward, it's archived. So if anyone ever asks us a question, we can send them to that and say, oh, if you want to know more about a budget, there you go.
So a little demystifying the process,
yes.
Breaking down the government speak into everyday language for the people in the community to understand. And
we live in a headline-driven world, right? So, like, this is an opportunity to go beneath the surface there.
How often do you think new episodes are going to drop?
We're looking at monthly, so every month, and we just dropped our first episode, and it can be accessed anywhere you get your podcasts, or you can just visit our website, and we have a link to it there. And we're really looking for ideas from the community. As Clayton said, what do people want to learn more about? You know, I had someone ask about, tell us about the historic district. How'd that come about, and what's behind that process? So we're really open to ideas. Folks want to email us at media@parkcity.gov. We're welcome to some suggestions.
And how often are you going to have new episodes?
Every month, monthly.
Every month. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we've talked about this a little bit, but if I just, you know, live on the other side of town, or even if I don't live in Park City, why would I care about this information? What is going to catch my attention?
Well, I think it's, as we mentioned earlier, it's an opportunity to share stories. So feature stories, human interest stories, stories about the legacy projects here in Park City. If you've ever wondered, how do we start our open space program? You know, we can listen and talk to some of the folks that got kicked it off. So it's a really just great human interest opportunity and an opportunity to share those stories on a little deeper level.
And listeners can find it anywhere they hear their regular podcasts. So
Spotify, Apple, Amazon, and
our
website is the easiest way to find it. It's anywhere you get your podcasts.
Can you give me a little preview of any upcoming episodes or what you're particularly excited about right now?
Well, we're looking ahead to doing a piece on our open space program, so that we have slated to come up next month. But we also might be doing some work on fire mitigation, because it is so top of mind right now, and we do some tremendous work, not only at the city, but also with our partners. So that would be another topic we're looking at.
Looking for any guest hosts or people to come on and talk back with your...
Are you saying you want to come on?
Well, not necessarily, but...
because that's a possibility.
Okay, well, I'll see if my schedule's open for that. I'm trying to think of what else I want to know. I think it's a really... Are other cities doing this? Like, did you look to a model from somewhere else in the country or even in the state?
Yeah, actually, when we started it, I took a just gander at other cities here in Utah that are doing podcasts, and there are quite a few. Harriman has a big one. Of course, our friends at Summit County have Summit and Six, which is a short podcast that they do. And then I've seen some others that are great models. Boulder has a really great one. But again, podcasts continue to grow as a great storytelling source, and we're happy to be able to use that.
When we were doing the promotion of the story, 150 million people listen to podcasts at least once a month in the country. That's a good 25%. What is that? That's a good substantial amount of people. And so why not get in the game and check it out? See if people will watch it. And like I said, it's a fluid format. It's brand new. So we really, really want feedback. Length, subject, format, host, whatever. It's only as good as people will listen to it. So we'll find out.
And when you talk to other cities, are they seeing that people are, you know, their constituents, their communities are really listening to those things?
They are, and it's been interesting too. Some are just audio, and some are both YouTube and audio. We're just doing audio at this point. Mm-hmm. We may break into YouTube as well, but it's been very popular and a really great addition to different communities' toolkits for communication.
And I have faith in the people of Park City. They're highly engaged. I know they'll listen to our podcast.
They are highly engaged. That is true. But if you can make Planning Commission interesting, you know, my hat's off to you.
We will.
There we go. Future
Absolutely.
Episode.
Future
yeah.
episode. And how's the podcast different from the information people might be getting from the Park Record or from KPCW?
Well, again, it's really looking at one topic and sharing, taking a deeper dive into that and get an opportunity for us to tell that story in a longer format. So that's where it would differ from the quick news bites that we have or articles.
Look no further than our first episode, the budget. Like, we've got, why don't you cover our budget? Well, it's a longer form conversation. So the budget was a perfect place to kick off.
Well, yeah, certainly. The news format that we work on, and even the Park Record works on, it can be somewhat limiting in time, in terms of we can't put every tiny detail
Correct.
Or explain.
We're not having 30-minute conversations typically here on
right.
the radio.
Right.
And in the newspaper, that's an even different conversation. So.
And I think to add to that, it's an opportunity to share the people behind the process at the city. So we have our budget director and our senior budget analyst being able to tell the story directly. So it's really great to get to know the people that are doing the work at the city.
That's really true. What else do we want to know? What else do you want to tell the public?
Well, like I said, we're going to repeat again. We want to hear news stories. We want to hear what is missing from our conversation, and we want to put it on the podcast and have people listen to it.
Would that include, like, you know, somebody from town, like a personality profile of somebody in town, or you just really
Absolutely.
Want to stick to?
Well, as it ties to the city, I think as well, you know, our tagline is where context meets community. So we want to share the stories from the city and, as you said, like kind of go deeper in the process or about some of the initiatives. So if there's an intersection with the city, absolutely.
Well, I think that's, if you guys don't have anything else, just thank you for coming, and I'm looking forward to hearing what everybody has to say at the city.
Thanks. Look for PC Cast where you get your podcasts.
PC Cast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, so here's a little more local news. Heber City is accepting applications for the fourth year of its Leadership Academy. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has the details.
People who live or work in Heber City and who want to learn more about city government can apply now to be part of this year's Heber Leadership Academy. According to city spokesperson Ryan Bennell, the program started after staff noticed some residents didn't understand how the city works.
It was clear that the boundaries between like federal, state, county, municipal, they were being blurred in a lot of citizens' eyes.
He says the leadership program aims to teach participants how to turn their ideas into city policy, and it's meant to empower locals to run for office.
Maybe you have your pet project like trails and parks or, you know, development or one of those things that are important to you. But then once you have the seat, you realize, whoa, there's a whole lot going on here that I had no idea about.
For residents without political aspirations, Bennell says there are still plenty of reasons to apply.
So I think that your satisfaction as a citizen and your ability to become civically involved in a good way really, really amplify if you take the time to educate yourself about how the process works.
Over 9 months, Leadership Academy participants explore topics like the local economy, public works, law enforcement, and more. Each class also does one big project as a group. Past class projects include designing Compass Plaza, the fountain outside City Hall, and creating a walking tour of historic Heber.
You know, as you graduate from the project, hopefully you can look back and see that you did something.
This year, since there are municipal elections, the Leadership Academy will also host an October candidate forum. Applications are due August 18th, and the first class is August 28th. More information about how to apply is available at kpcw.org. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Summer workers moving to unionize at Park City Mountain say the skills required for their jobs warrant higher wages. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more.
A majority of the employees on the Summer Bike Patrol and Trail Crew are members of the Park City Professional Ski Patrol Association, the union representing winter ski patrollers at Park City Mountain. Sid Heyer, the union's Mountain Village Vice President, said the Bike Patrol and Trail Crew have a wide range of tasks.
They are responsible for responding to any medical situations that were to happen on the mountain when it's open. And also the trail crew specifically will do a lot of Sawyer work. And so they are actively using chainsaws and heavy equipment. And they make the mountain fun to ski in the winter because they cut back all the brush in the summer.
Heyer said summer patrollers are tasked with responding to any medical emergencies at the resort, whether that's a mountain bike crash or an accident on the Alpine slide. By petitioning to organize, the Bike Patrol and Trail Crew are moving to become their own union. The group would be represented by the Communication Workers of America, which represents the ski patrol and lift maintenance team at Park City Mountain. Heyer said summer workers want to bring up wages to match those offered during the ski season.
So we're hoping to have union representation for these people because they are required to have medical certifications. They're asked to participate in lift evacuation exercises and many other skilled and dangerous jobs, just like in the winter. And they feel that these dangerous scenarios that they are put in and all of the skills that they are required to have warrant higher wages.
The group has not provided details to KPCW on what summer workers are currently paid or how many employees would make up the summer union. During the Park City Mountain Ski Patrol strike this past winter, the union sought to increase base wages from $21 to $23 per hour. The minimum wage for all workers at the resort is $20 per hour. Heyer said a supermajority of summer workers signed the petition to form a new union.
So we're all great friends with our managers and we're great friends with our supervisors. And any push to unionize is never a negative reflection on them. It's just a reflection of the unit coming together to bargain for what they think they need.
They're now waiting to hear back from the National Labor Relations Board. The group did request voluntary recognition from Vail Resorts. A spokesperson for the resort said the company is aware of the petition filed by bike patrollers and the trail crew. The resort spokesperson said in a statement, quote, "We believe a direct connection to our employees fosters the strongest working relationship between our employees and their resort leaders, but we respect their right to file this petition and are engaging in this process," end quote. Bike Haul is offered for 3 months during the summer at Park City Mountain, along with an additional month of reduced operations. It is not currently a profitable line of business, according to the resort spokesperson. Park City Mountain spokesperson also said summer employees who perform lift evacuations are compensated extra for their work. They added that operations duties at the resort during summer are less complex than in the winter. And as a note, Sid Heyer is a former KPCW DJ. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Ever since news of the development that's now known as East Deer Valley broke, locals have been wondering about what they can expect in terms of snow quality. Here to help us understand the technology that will be used to whiten the Mayflower slopes is Chris Cushing of the SE Group. Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Okay. I just need to know, how does someone like find themselves in their career of snowmaker?
I think you have to have a passion for skiing and a desire to help resorts serve their guests, and an engineering degree certainly helps.
And did you grow up on a mountain somewhere?
I grew up back in New Hampshire, northern New Hampshire. Grew up on Cannon Mountain, which is actually the home mountain of Bodie Miller. I'm an Eastern skier.
So tell us a little more about your background and the history of the relationship between SE and Deer Valley.
The relationship started back in 1978, actually. My father was also with our company, and he was hired by Edgar Stern to design the original Deer Valley Resort back in 78 and oversaw its development till it opened in I think it was 81 or 82. And he kind of helped out Deer Valley until he retired in 95. By that time, I had started with the company and kind of took over the reins from him, helping Deer Valley with some of their more recent expansions. When the Excel Group acquired the Mayflower property and put the plans into motion to develop the site, they contacted us and asked that we help them out to design East Village.
And so tell us about that scope of work that you're doing, and how many other resorts have you been involved with during your career?
I've been involved with hundreds of resorts around the world. Asia, Europe, South America, Australasia, but most of my work has been here in North America. Our company works with, say, most of the ski resorts here in the United States, it's been a lot of fun.
So I'm sure that every resort there are different challenges for putting in a snowmaking system. What are you finding on the East Deer Valley project?
Well, you know, typically the big challenge for snowmaking is a water source. A lot of areas, particularly back east, well, I guess across the country, there's limitations to how much water they can draw from whatever their source is, whether it's a creek or a well. Resorts will have certain water rights and that type of thing. You know, one of the things that was a real advantage for Deer Valley East is the fact that the Jordanelle Reservoir is literally across the highway, and the developer was able to acquire significant water rights from the Jordanelle JSSD Jordan-L Special Services District. So they have a very robust water supply very close by, which is very uncommon. And the other real benefit to the snowmaking operation that'll debut this winter at East Village is it'll be, you know, by far the most sophisticated snowmaking system in the country, certainly in North America, with automation and the latest technology and fan guns and pump control it's really going to be an amazing system that has very strong firepower that'll allow them to cover the slopes with snow very quickly.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that technology, like how it's developed? And I mean, we all ski by the snowmaking machines, but I don't think most of us know exactly how they work.
Yeah, it's a really fairly simple. The snow guns, there's different types of snow guns. The big fan guns, which are kind of look like big barrels up on towers or on sleds. And then there's the more common tower stick guns, they call them. They're low air consumption guns. But in either case, there's nozzles, small nozzles that the water is pressurized water is forced through these nozzles, and it breaks up the stream into small droplets. But there needs to be they call them a nucleator. It's basically ice crystals that the other droplets form, transition into ice around. And in the fan gun case, there's a nucleating nozzle that, I'm getting a little technical here, but
that's
a mixture of air and water that allows these ice crystals to form more readily, and then the rest of the nozzles blow into that nucleator nozzle, and it transforms the other droplets into ice more quickly. And with the fan guns, there's a big fan that blows the plume out onto the slope. With the smaller stick guns, the water pressure is what sends the plume out over the trail.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, is there any significant difference between snow made through a snowmaking system and like natural snow that's coming to us from above?
Snowflakes are snowflakes. They're
right.
They're shaped like a snowflake. the water that comes out of a snow gun is a frozen droplet. So it's not really a snowflake. It's essentially a small chunk of ice, I guess you would say. Very small. Machine-made snow is a little bit more dense than natural snow. It's a lot more durable just because of that density.
Does it make for any sort of more consistent ride for a skier or boarder?
I think that, again, being more dense, it's a little bit more durable and with the snow groomers, they can, shape the snow perhaps a little bit better than the natural snow. But it's a pretty nuanced, difference between, once it's all groomed, certainly natural snow, and you can feel it when you're skiing on a mountain that's had recent natural snow and it's been groomed, you can tell versus just purely man-made snow or machine-made snow that just isn't quite as smooth and silky.
Mm-hmm. And the climate over at Deer Valley East is a little bit different than it is on this side of the mountain. So has that been a challenge for you guys?
Well, surprisingly, when we started looking at the snowmaking system at Deer Valley East, one of the things that the snowmaking engineer we worked with did was look at historical temperature data to assess, how big the system needed to be and how much snow and that type of thing. And to do that, he found two snow tell sites. These are I think NOAA installations that are around the country. And one of these sites was at snow park at Deer Valley, the snow park base area, mm-hmm. and one was over very near the East Village. And what we found is that the temperatures on the East Village side were actually slightly colder than on the snow park side. So I think from a temperature perspective, there really is very, very little difference between the original Deer Valley and the East Village side. There is an elevation difference. The East Village is a little bit lower in elevation than Snow Park, for example. But again, the temperatures are the same or a little bit colder over there. And so from a snowmaking perspective, the climate and temperatures and humidity and everything are very, very good for snowmaking. The lower elevation has more of an impact, in late season when it's starting to warm up and can have a little more effect on the snow.
Mm-hmm. And when do you think snowmaking is going to start this year?
Well, that's up to Mother Nature.
Well, that part, yes. Your part's
typically,
a little...
typically, snowmaking starts, in some cases late October, but generally early November is when the snow guns fire up.
I was going to say you and Mother Nature have different kinds of magic there, right?
Right.
And are we going to be seeing... the snowmaking guns over most of the area in East Village, or will it be just concentrated on some particular runs?
There will be, I would say most of the runs are going to be covered, or will have snowmaking coverage. I would guess, maybe 70% of the run. I don't know the exact number, but mm-hmm. I'm guessing about 70% of the runs will have snowmaking. So snowmaking from the very top to the very bottom. The runs that return to the village will obviously have 100% snowmaking coverage. Every run that comes back into the village will have snowmaking this coming year.
And then in terms of like the timing, once you start, do you typically make snow through the end of the season, or is it some point where, there's a cutoff date?
Yeah, generally not. So generally they'll start making snow in, again, early November, and make snow through, in the case of East Village, because of the firepower of the system, they'll be able to cover all of the terrain that has snowmaking infrastructure before Christmas. And again, this is all weather dependent. We have to,
right.
Only can do so much to cooperate with the weather. But generally, they should be able to have all of those runs covered by Christmas. And then there might be some patchwork up until maybe January, and then they shut everything down typically for the season. Again, if we have a low snow year or under some circumstances, they might fire up, later in January or February, just to patch things up and add some cover here and there.
Of all the resorts that you've worked on over the years, do you have a favorite where the snowmaking was like the most fun or was the project was the most satisfying for you?
Well, we've just to be clear, our company, SE Group, we don't design the snowmaking systems mm-hmm. themselves. We design the ski runs and the lifts and everything else. Mm-hmm. So, this is certainly the most incredible snowmaking system I've ever seen installed in terms of, again, the automation and the sophistication and everything. And I think the skiers are going to recognize it, literally these new guns do produce better snow than the old, the more early on guns. So it's going to be, it's going to be really well received, I'm sure. Like I said before, there aren't a lot of resorts that have that level of sophistication, and they're only, over the last 5 or 10 years have the snow guns really kind of transitioned into this much higher level of snow quality and control. Those resorts that do have the new guns and the automation and so forth, you really can tell that the snowmaking is a higher quality. The existing system at Deer Valley has been, it's been implemented, since the mid 80s, and But recently they have, installed some more high-tech guns and that are more energy efficient and also make better snow. So, they're all, the snow is key. You know, you got to have good snow. So all the resorts are trying to introduce these new guns that produce, better snow, better skiing snow. And so I couldn't tell you which is the best. They're all just sort of transitioning. I guess the ones that have transitioned most are probably the ones that have the better quality snow.
So the last thing I want is some insider information. Since you've been designing those runs and developing that vision for East Valley, which run is going to be the one we're all raving about this winter?
That's easy. There's a run that it's called Redemption. Uh-huh. It's a run that it's about 2.5 miles long and about 2,800 vertical feet. It's a really great run. It's kind of like, for those of you who know, Stein's run at Deer Valley, it's basically more than two of those end to end with very similar characteristics. It's a very rolly and nice turns and the views of the reservoir and the Uintas are spectacular. So that's by far going to be a signature run for Deer Valley.
Well, that sounds great. So I'll meet you at the top of the chair.
Sounds good.
Okay. We've been speaking with Chris Cushing. We really appreciate you joining us this morning and hope to see you when the snow flies.
You bet.
You can't turn on the TV or go into Walmart without being reminded that it's back to school season again. Here to talk about preparations for the new year and a special event coming up is Scott Stewart, the middle school dean at the Weilemann School of Discovery. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
Doing wonderful. It's a beautiful morning.
Are you getting that back to school excitement? Have you been out shopping for your outfit for the first day?
I have it all picked out. It's laid out on the floor in the living room, and I'm ready to go.
Don't we all have like a million pictures of us and our siblings with our lunch boxes on the first day of school that our parents took?
Oh, my goodness. And my daughter, I have a fourth-grade daughter, and she has to say it's planned out. It's been planned out for weeks.
Oh, good for
her. She's thought about where we need to take the picture. It's all in the works.
That's great. I'm glad she's excited about school because not all of us were.
No, it changes as you get older. By the time you hit middle school, the enthusiasm wanes.
Yes, a little bit. So tell us, for those of us who aren't familiar with the Weilemann School, tell us about it.
So the Weilemann School is a free public charter school that is in Summit County, and we are located just across the street from Jeremy Ranch. We started, this is our 16th year that we've been a school, and our kind of primary focus is the liberal arts. We are a liberal arts school that incorporates technology and project-based learning kind of into the curriculum, and one of the things that we prioritize too is getting our kids outside and having experiences in kind of the outdoors, where the outdoors become the classroom. And we have a lot of programs and initiatives that use that as kind of a teaching tool. And it's one of the things that we really love. You may have seen our affectionately called Moby van driving around. It's a little black van that we take kids, students out on small teacher-led learning excursions in the outdoors.
So this is where the discovery part of your name comes from?
Exactly.
So I hear you have an upcoming summer send-off event. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we're so excited. On the 16th of August from 5 to 8 p.m., we have a summer send-off event that is at Woodward. Woodward's just down the street from us, and one of the local places that we have really enjoyed building a relationship with. Our students love going there. We use them for our outdoor and PE classes regularly, and we wanted to celebrate the end of summer and the start of the school year with a big community event where we could bring everybody together. Families from all over are welcome, and put on a great time. We'll have Jake and the Heist that will be performing. There'll be a buffet dinner. Wasatch Brewing Company is providing the beer. There'll be Olympic guest speakers. It's going to be a really fun, exciting night.
That sounds amazing. Doesn't sound like my elementary school, I got to tell you.
No. We're trying to create a place that's the place we wish we went when we were in school.
That seems like a good plan. And so tell me, what does your enrollment look like for the coming year?
You know, the enrollment's looking decent. We, as everybody knows, enrollment's down across the state and the country, across the board. But we are in, you know, good shape for the next school year, and we're looking forward to in the next school year. We've got all kinds of initiatives that we are implementing that will hopefully attract more students to our school. One of them, we got a grant last year from the state charter school board that allowed us to partner with a group called Challenge Success, which is associated with the Stanford Department of Education. And their whole focus is to bring families, students, and teachers together and increase engagement and belonging and a kind of a sense of community in the school. And we've just started our 2-year partnership with them this month. And then we also just found out that we were chosen as one of the schools in the state, one of the 24 schools, to be to work with the Utah State Board of Education on the A2A AI initiative that they're starting. That is the assessment to achievement and incorporating artificial intelligence. And what their focus is improving student proficiency and bringing proficiency levels for all students up. And we were so fortunate to be chosen as one of the 24 schools to have a 3-year partnership with them. So we've got some great things going that we're looking forward to on that front.
So are you really talking about developing some sort of AI literacy, understanding what it is, how it works, what is responsible use of the technology?
Exactly. It's not replacing teachers with, you know, AI or any of those things. It's actually becoming aware of the best educational tools for teachers to help them be more proficient in their classrooms and be able to meet individual student needs, and then expanding that to helping the students learn how to effectively use the tools. And we feel like this is one of the really important things right now as we push into a new area of education where AI is obviously going to have an influence. And we want our students and our teachers to kind of be on the cutting edge of using it responsibly.
I think that's really a challenge for all of us. I mean, it seems to have, like, every time I do a Google search, it seems like, you know, there's AI helping me along, and I'm still trying to figure it out.
Right, and I think we all are. And that's one of the reasons I'm really excited about this, because for those of us that didn't grow up with this kind of technology as a native language that we speak, we've got to learn it. And then we want to introduce it to our students as soon as possible so that it becomes a really effective tool for them, and not just something that will, you know, make work easier for them.
Right.
But it's just something that they're, yeah.
Yeah, we don't want to replace education with AI. We want to actually be helping our kids learn.
Exactly.
Can you talk to me a little bit about the cell phone use in your school? It's been a big topic across the state. The legislature's, you know, mandating cell phone policies. We had an early start on that here in the Park City schools. Where is Wileman in this conversation?
Yeah, the cell phones, since their inception, have always been kind of an issue on how to use them and allow them in the schools. And we've gone through a lot of iterations where we wanted to work with the students and giving them chances and different kinds of things. And ultimately that didn't work. And last year, kind of before the legislative mandate, we banned cell phones and smartwatches in the school during class time during the day. Students bring cell phones, they have to be often in backpacks. Smartwatches have to be in, airplane mode. And there was a kind of a no tolerance policy a little bit already last year, where if the students had them out, they were placed in the office and parents had to come pick them up, which is essentially what the state's kind of moved to on a statewide basis this year. So we're kind of already there. It's something that we've had implemented for at least a year, and we're in full support of it.
And are you noticing any difference in, like, students in class during class time now that the cell phones are banned? I mean, there's been
absolutely
some positive data about that, yeah.
Absolutely. The cell phones in classrooms and technology generally You can't just throw technology at students and expect them to know how to use it effectively. They're just not going to. And it needs to be under the direction of teachers, whether it's computers or cell phones or any of those things. And student engagement's noticeably different when the cell phones are expected to be off and in backpacks. And that allows the teachers to teach more effectively, and it allows the students to actually be engaged and paying attention more.
And so was that a community, like a school-wide conversation with students and parents to make that decision to ban them?
Yes, absolutely. We have a lot. There's pretty much universal support for that kind of that policy as we've implemented it.
So just tell me, like, if somebody knows nothing about Wileman, what would you want them to know? What is, like, the best thing about being there? Or I don't know if you've been in other educational settings, but what is different about it?
Yeah, I've been a teacher for 26 years. I've been doing it for a long time, and I've been at Wileman now for 16 years. And the reason that I've stayed and the reason that I've sent my own children, I have a ninth grader going into 10th grade this year, a seventh grader, and a fourth grader. The younger two are at Wileman this year. And we've chosen to send our kids to Wileman because of the community, because of the education that they get, and because of the experiences that they have with the outdoors and the outdoor learning program.
Well, anything else you want us to know?
Come to our event on Saturday the 16th, and we'll have faculty, staff, people there to ask questions and have a good time and enjoy being together.
And if somebody wants information about Wileman and enrollment and all of those things, where do they go?
Come to our website, or they can and call our number and ask for me, and I'm happy to have a conversation with anyone anytime.
Okay, great. We've been speaking with Scott Stewart from the Wileman School. We wish you an exciting first day. Please send us a picture of you in your first day outfit.
Oh, I will absolutely do it. Expect it.
Okay, thanks for joining us this morning. Provisions in Donald Trump's beautiful budget bill could impact efforts to develop affordable housing in the Wasatch Back. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports on changes to the low-income housing tax credit program.
Low-income housing tax credits, often referred to as LIHTC, were first introduced in 1986 under the Tax Reform Act, passed during President Ronald Reagan's second term. It allows the Department of Housing and Urban Development to give state and local agencies the equivalent of $10 billion to issue LIHTC for acquisition, rehabilitation, or new construction of affordable housing. The Park City Council has set a goal to house 15% of the city's workforce by 2032. City Housing and Development Coordinator Sarah Weinman said LIHTC is a critical tool in reaching that goal.
LIHTC helps us have less burden as a city and be able to develop more. And especially for it being such a high-cost resort town, it's one of the ways that we make our housing financially viable for the city, the workforce, and the future. And truthfully, like without LIHTC, we probably will have a very difficult time meeting that 15% goal. It makes it unrealistic.
Under the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which President Trump signed last month, the federal government plans to expand the LIHTC program. Summit County Economic Development and Housing Director Jeff Jones said the changes include more funding for housing projects and less stringent financing requirements for developers.
I think that actually is going to be a really good thing. It's such a valuable program. We have a number of tax credit projects in Summit County and in Park City. And these are the projects that we're able to get the lowest rents for people, which I think, you know, because we have a service-based economy, that's really, really important.
Changes to the LIHTC program are scheduled to go into effect next year. In Utah, LIHTC funding is allocated through the Utah Housing Corporation, which handles funding applications for projects. Mountainlands Community Housing Trust Executive Director Jason Glidden said it is a highly competitive process. Glidden said he's still working to fully understand the coming LIHTC changes, but is optimistic.
With how oversubscribed the requests have been at the state level over the last couple of years, it's got to be a bonus. It's going to be hopefully help to fund more projects in the future.
Mountainlands has been unable to get LIHTC funding for its redevelopment of the Holiday Village and Parkside Apartments in Park City over the past 2 years. Glidden said they expect to receive scoring results, which determine funding, from their third application soon. While the LIHTC program is getting a boost, the Trump administration does plan to cut funding for Section 8 housing subsidies, which will largely impact high population states like California, New York, and Texas. Park City Municipal and Summit County are financial supporters of KPCW. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
And once again, you've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. I'm Jennifer Dobner, filling in for Roger Goldman. We hope he'll be back next week and feeling much better. Thanks so much for joining us.